We go. So welcome to the Neurobiology of Pleasure. I had the joy of doing this like just a week or two before the real lockdown happened at a hypnosis group in the St. Pete area. And it's kind of fun to talk about this, especially when this is going on, because we're locked down and there's a lot of fear and there's a lot of apprehension. So let's back up and just talk about the neurobiology of pleasure and how does it work and how can we use it? You know, especially in this time of what's going on. We'll talk about that. And this is just an information call, no sales, no nothing. Let's just have some fun. One way to think about it is as within, so without. There's, you know, in the old NLP thing, they always said your internal representations, your internal state, and your external behavior, it created a triage, if you will. And if you change any one of these, it changes the others. If you change how you're representing things in your mind, it will change your internal state, which may change your external behavior. Of course, if you change your external behavior, you act as if, that's what the whole act as if is, it may change your internal representation and your internal state. Each one of these is linked to the other. And that's what we're going to be talking about here, you know, how to do these kind of things. So let's talk about the brain and pleasure. All physical pleasure is processed through the brain. And the brain can increase or decrease pleasure. And we all know this, if you're into hypnosis and NLP, and if not, we know it, though, that it can create physical pleasure on its own. Just thinking about it can create a physical response. Why? Why do we want to learn this, right? That's what I want to talk about. To understand how techniques work or don't work, especially with the NLP and the hypnosis, and give more insight into how it works, which adds to your credibility overall. So if people ask, you could give the explanation. They may not want it, but it's good to know. So a lot of people that know me know I've been in the addiction world for almost over 35 years, and it's led me to study the hypnosis, the NLP, become a clinical psychologist. And By studying addictions, it opens up an awful lot of areas of the brain and about how your brain works or doesn't work, because they really didn't know how this stuff worked, 25, 30 years ago. Now we're getting more and more. But there's four specific brain regions that are involved in pleasure, much like addiction. In fact, some people would say addiction is pleasure gone awry or pleasure gone, you know, too much, right? So if we look at it, how it works, then we can begin to understand it. And the first center that's involved in addiction and or pleasure is the reward center, the nucleus accumbens, a couple other centers of the brain. This is where dopamine is created. I always talk about what are the, you know, neurochemicals of hypnosis and NLP. This is one of the big ones, right? Dopamine. It increases pleasure. It's the main driver for pleasure. And so if you know that, if you access this part of your brain and it gets going, it can enhance pleasure. So that's the ventral area of the brain, the nucleus accumbens, and it's deep in the brain, but gives you that reward boost. The second pleasure center is our memory center, the amygdala and the hippocampus. It's that felt good, I want more response. In NLP and hypnosis, we call it anchoring, you know. Classical psychology, it's stimulus response training, right? The memory itself can begin to access the parts of your brain where you begin to make dopamine. You start enhancing pleasure even before it happens, right? Now we're seeing it on the other side. I don't want to do a brain thing on it, on how fear works and why it's cascading through every aspect, right? But let's talk about the pleasure. So if you have a good pleasurable memory, it can enhance pleasure. We know that, right? This is a lot of the anchoring techniques and things like that. And it's totally trainable. The pleasure, pain, stimulus response, your brain is trained this way. And again, this is why some people find some things pleasurable, other people don't. You know, if you meet someone that really finds exercise pleasurable, someone that doesn't have that will never understand it, and vice versa. So it can be trained. This is what we can do with this. And the third center of the brain is the orbital frontal cortex. This is where motivation happens. If you have your deep brain, you know, like your reptilian brain, and it kind of builds out. And this area of the brain is where you motivate yourself. You think about it. I like that stuff last time. I want more of it. Or I like when this happens. I want more of it. right? And so then you can think about it, and then it also backs into that part of the brain where dopamine is created, and these begin to all link together. And so the last area is the prefrontal cortex. This is where you could put the brakes on things if you choose to. In addiction, it's usually too late when this part of the brain kicks in. If it starts from the deep inside where you start getting the dopamine response, whether you think about it and create the dopamine response, and then once all of this is happening, by the time it hits your prefrontal cortex, the front of your brain where the higher thought is, it may be too late to stop it, right? And this begins to show that you can think your way into or out of a pleasurable event. So this is how your brain's working. So how can we use this? What's really going on? So it's the dopamine. It's the, it boosts the serotonin, makes you feel good. All this stuff's going on deep in your brain. And it kind of ties into the same centers of your brain that's used in habits, because usually a habit is formed when there's some pleasure in it, or it removes stress, right? And, you know, when they do the traditional study of how a habit's developed, what happens is there's a cue, like a click, or if you drop a rat in a maze, that's the cue. It drops into the maze, or the wall goes up, and it goes into the routine, like run, turn left. You know, it does how rats think. They would scratch and sniff, right? And then it gets the reward. And then once it happens, the next time that cue happens, it'll go faster down the routine to get the reward. And this is how we learn things. This is good. This can become a problem when we start looking at pleasure. And how can it be a problem? Well, the first few rounds, when you're thinking a lot, you have high brain activity, right? So you, like the rat, when the thing goes up, you hear the click, it scratches, that's how it thinks, and it's sniffing and doing all this stuff, it's thinking, right? And then it gets the reward, and once it gets the reward, that's where the chocolate, it gets that rush of pleasure, right? That dopamine rush. But then after several rounds, what happens, you get the cue, if you will, like the wall goes up or here's the click, and it starts thinking, and then its brain kind of goes to sleep. And it runs down, gets the chocolate. It still gets a boost from the chocolate, but it's not as mentally engaged. It's why you can get bored with something at one time you found pleasurable, right? If you think about it, that kind of makes sense. You know, something you used to find very pleasurable, if you do it all the time, it may become less pleasurable, right? Because, and also your brain's not involved. You know where you see this, just as an aside, sometimes you'll go to a health club, gym, if you will, and you'll see people working out. They are not mentally engaged. They're watching the news on TV or some movie or something, or they're reading a book. They are not mentally engaged, right? And so it will kind of decrease the pleasure, right? And it's why when you increase the mental activity, it increases the pleasure, right? And that's part of that biofeedback loop, right? And it's also why autopilot, lowers the pleasure sensations. You get this same old effect, because it doesn't stimulate the amygdala and the hippocampus. It kind of bypasses it. You get the cue, and you'll get the dopamine, but it doesn't engage the middle part. So it's not the big driver to go get it done. Like, okay, right? Rather than you're excited. Because when when the whole brain's engaged, you get totally excited about doing things. And there was a study, and the purpose of the study was to use brain imaging technology to measure changes in blood flow to areas of the brain as an individual performs certain tasks, right? And it uses functional MRIs to examine blood flow to areas of the brain when they participate in certain tasks, right, that are engaged in visual perception, visual recognition, and memory, which are the same areas that we do with pleasure, right? And so how does visualization affect the brain and or pleasure? And I'll tie all this together in a moment. You know, visualization movement changes how the brain networks are organized. It stimulates brain regions involved in rehearsal of movement. you know, and like the forebrain, which we talked about, it's priming the brain and body for action so it can be more effective. This is where you start getting excited when the cue is coming up, like, right? And if you keep yourself engaged, if there's something slightly different about it, it's going to make you more excited. Right. And when a group of neurons get activated by thinking hard, like about a math problem or a vibrant color, something, within a second, blood flow to those brain cells increases. Just thinking about it. You haven't done anything. You just think about like doing the math problem or seeing the flower, doing the dance, whatever it is that you're just thinking about, it stimulates that part of your brain. Right? So you begin to get the dopamine rush and everything kicks in, right? And, you know, if you can keep the brain engaged, the pleasure is going to be enhanced. And now we also know, part of the study, they were scanning the brains of subjects while they were hypnotized. It happened in a school of medicine. Stanford was one of them. And they were able to see the neural changes associated with hypnosis. You know, first, they saw a decrease in activity called the dorsal anterior cingulate. And this is the part of your brain that helps scan out everything in the external environment. So what happens when there's a decrease in that, you become absorbed in what you're doing. You can't hear things. Other things can happen. You know, things just kick in. So when you're in hypnosis, excuse me, my phone rang in the background. You're absorbed, so you're not worrying about anything else. This explains critical thought, right? This explains critical thought. Excuse me. You know, I'm sorry. That's what's happening in your brain. Excuse me, I got off track there. I thought I turned my phone off. Again, you know, if I was totally focused, it wouldn't bother me. And I am focused, but it's just only something that would get your attention from the outside. That's a cue that's usually important, phone ringing, things like that. So the first thing they saw when you're hypnotized is that you focus your attention and you begin to suspend critical thought. And then you see an increase in the connection between the two other areas of the brain, the prefrontal cortex and the deeper parts of your brain. The brain-body connection kicks in, which helps the brain process that controls what's going on in the body. This bypasses the critical factors. You hear hypnotists say that forever, going back to, Jerry Kine, and the one before him, Gil Boyne, and et cetera, right? And it heightens the effect. Why under hypnosis? It can heighten the effect, and the make-believe becomes real. Your body doesn't know the difference, right? We know now, because they did some studies, where if you have a big fear of dogs and someone puts you in trance and they have you vividly imagine a dog, your body's going to respond as if it's right there in front of the dog, whatever it happens to be, right? So we know hypnosis can focus your attention on a body part so it can increase blood flow, right? There was a really cool study done where they had someone practice their strength like this, right? And they and they took the control group and they would do this like 10 minutes a day, right? Right, great. Then they took a second group and they showed them how to do it, so what it felt like. And then they would have them vividly imagine that without even doing it, just imagine, so they could learn the feeling of what it's like. They could imagine it, right? And then they had the control group that did nothing. What they found, of course, the people that were actually physically doing this, their strength went up like whatever it was, 30-something percent. But what was kind of interesting, the people that learned and could vividly imagine, especially if they could relax and vividly imagine the same feelings in their forearm, their strength went up like 20%. It was not quite as much as actually doing it, but almost as much, right? And so accessing strong memories increases the blood flow, right? So maybe that's why people that know how to do this, they can stay in shape even when they're not exercising, right? And so you can link two things to create new pleasure. This is why I want to talk about pleasure in the first place. This is how techniques work. One of my favorite techniques is the Godiva chocolate pattern, where you take something you love to do, right? And you get that feeling and you put it on something you need to do that you don't want to do. That's the Godiva chocolate pattern. And so here's the pattern. I'll give you an example. If you wanted to do this right now, if you could think about what's something you need to do that maybe you're not doing. Maybe it's like in the lockdown right now. Well, this is being recorded. This is when we're still in the lockdown. I refuse to call it quarantine because I'm in the language. It's technically a lockdown. So maybe you need to exercise. You just can't get motivated. You know, you could turn on a YouTube video and do Tai Bo or a dance class. You can do all kinds of stuff, right? There, maybe you have weights in your house. Maybe you have other stuff, but you're not doing it. So you know you need to do it. There's no motivation there. And if there's no motivation there, that motivation knows it's going to be reinforced by pleasure. So this may be happening because maybe you really don't get much pleasure from exercise. Or maybe you do get some pleasure from exercise, but maybe it's more specific, like you get exercise when you're out with other people playing tennis or when you're at the health club and you can interact with other people. Well, that part's removed, so it's broken that part of it. And so there's no motivation because you're not going to get the pleasure of some of the things that go with the exercise. Like it might be the socialization. It could be the just, you know, every day after you work out, you get a cup of coffee, whatever it is. So, you know, we don't know. And that's all in there. So we can access this and we can help you get that motivation. And here's the little hidden part that people don't understand about this swish pattern called the Godiva chocolate pattern. Which is, let's say you have the thing that you need to do that you're not motivated to do. So let's say it's like exercise. So if you could close your eyes and see yourself doing an exercise that you could physically do, you know, you're not going to imagine yourself doing a 2-hour aerobic class if you've been sitting around for the last month on lockdown, right? But you could physically do, you could see yourself exercising, you see yourself doing a Tai Bo class or a dance class or a yoga class, but you could see yourself doing it, but it's totally disassociated. So you're not trying to step into something that you know is not real. Your critical factors go, man, that's BS. You're not doing it. So if you could just picture yourself doing it, and if you add some things that don't seem like they would have much effect, but from my testing of it, my unofficial research testing is, so you see yourself, like, let's say, doing an exercise routine. And, okay, you see the picture in your mind as clear as you can. And for some reason, there's a smile on your face. Doesn't have to make sense, but there's a smile on your face. And you could see you're really exercising. So you're like drenched in sweat or, you know, but for some reason, it's totally disassociated. So there's no feel, there's no neck. Okay, yeah, I can see myself doing, for some reason, there's a smile. I don't know. Great. So now you have that disassociated feeling or disassociated picture. Now what you do is open your eyes and then close your eyes if you're doing the exercise. And then imagine something that you love to do, something that makes you excited. And actually, if you could find something that you feel more excited about doing it than sometimes actually doing it, you know, many times, like going on vacation, how many times you get all excited about going on vacation? So you know, you're packing, you're planning the trip and you're all excited and you get there and the vacation's okay. Yeah. It's like, okay, it wasn't that much fun, you know, but it's that excitement because you don't know what'll happen yet. You know, if you're the type that like to, if you do it now, great. Or when you were younger, you get all dressed up to go to the club, you know, because, ooh, what'll happen? Will I meet somebody? Will this happen? Will that happen? There's all these. And it's also that part gets your brain engaged, doesn't it? Because you don't know. So you have to fill in the blanks. Oh, I'm going to meet somebody. I'm going to do this. This is going to happen. That's going to happen, right? It fills in the blanks. So it makes you feel excited. And it's the anticipation that we're going through. Because anticipation is another word for motivation. When you anticipate something, you really want to do it. And that'll give you the motivation to do it, right? So what you do is you think about something you absolutely love to do. This technique was created by Richard Bandler. And what he talked about, and I was in the room when he did it, he had someone who needed to do paperwork, right? And so he had them vividly imagine doing the paperwork, sitting at their desk. They would always do their paperwork the same place, fine. But disassociate, because they go, yeah, and you saw the physical, and people didn't focus in on this. You saw her go, yeah, I'm doing, okay, I'll do my paperwork. Right? He goes, no, for some reason, I would add in, now, for some reason, when you see that picture, and you don't know why, your shoulders are back, your head's up, there's a smile on your face, and you're doing the paperwork. Great. Right? But disassociated. Excuse me. And then he said, what's something you would do as much of if you could? And she goes, I would eat Godiva chocolate, you know, if it didn't make you gain weight or, you know, cause cavity, whatever the beliefs are about it. She did. And he asked, he goes, no, I don't eat that much of it, but it's such a pleasure when I get to eat it. So he had her step into the anticipation of knowing she had some Godiva chocolate saved for herself. That anticipation, it's going to be so good. And he had to really associate into the feeling. So if you think about something you love to do, and you feel that excitement, where in your body do you feel it? And I would say, as you're feeling that excitement, where in your body, maybe it's your heart, maybe it's your stomach, maybe it's your head, maybe it's everywhere, where do you feel it? And as you're feeling that excitement, what color pops into your head? What color pops into your head to represent that feeling of excitement, right? Great. Now really feel that feeling of excitement. Now fade down what you see and hear. Just keep that color and that feeling, and then bring up that disassociated picture of you exercising. And for some reason, there's a smile on your face, your shoulders back, you're enjoying it, okay. And then let your mind go blank. Good. Now, again, step into the experience of being excited with anticipation. You're going to do this thing that you love to do, whatever it is. The example was Godiva chocolate. Might be packing for a vacation, spending time with friends, making love, going dancing, whatever it is. But you're right before you get to do it, you're so excited, you can't stand it. Fade down everything you see and hear. Keep the feeling of excitement, that color of excitement, and then bring up that disassociated picture of you being of you exercising, shoulders back, head up, covered in sweat. You're into it. Doesn't have to make sense. It just is. Great. Now let's do it one more time. Let your mind go blank. Now bring up the thing you're excited about doing. You feel the excitement. You can taste it. It's there. Oh my God, you can't wait. Just keep the feeling and the color. Now bring up that disassociated picture of you exercising. Smile on your face, shoulders back, you're really into it. Doesn't have to make sense. Great. Now open your eyes. Good. Now, if you did that, you'd be more prone to go exercise because you're taking the feeling of the anticipation, which what's that doing? It's going back to the parts of your brain to make you feel motivated, right? Right there deep in your brain. And you start feeling the motivation, which starts releasing the dopamine to increase the pleasure. And then you're laying it disassociated on the picture of you exercising. But again, you have to have a smile on your face and your shoulders back. You're not just enduring exercising for some reason, you're enjoying exercising. The same way you would enjoy the Godiva chocolate or the dancing or the vacation or the making love, whatever it is that you picked. So, wow. So you put those two together, right? This is how it works in your brain, and you'd be more likely to do it, right? And so I added another level because I also know that you're very motivated to do certain things. Most of us are. If you get that motivation going and you get that anticipation, you could go do it. Like, ooh, will it be? And it'll spill over. Your brain will generate things. Like, will it be a good workout today? Will I have fun doing it? And even if you ask, those of you who know me, I'm a fanatic about learning how to ask the right questions. So when you're getting ready to do the exercise, and if you're feeling a little excited, you can ask yourself, ooh, what am I going to do different in my routine today? What am I going to learn different today? What am I going to learn about my body? Whatever it is, your brain will go, okay. Or how can I increase the pleasure of my workout? And then just go and start. Your brain will fill in the answer for you in an exciting way. So let's take that. Now, if we add one more level, it's almost like unfair advantage if you add the next level, which is, so you have, now you think about exercise and you bring up that color, whatever it was, of anticipation, and you start to go do it. Let's add a different level. What if you had a dread about not exercising? What if skipping a workout was like not showering for 3 or 4 days, right? Of course, now in the lockdown, there's some talk of people not quite keeping up their personal hygiene as much as they usually do because you're not out and about, you know, you're just at home. But how would you really feel if you were forced to not like shower or brush your teeth for a few days? You'd probably feel dirty, grody, disgusted, right? So if you take that feeling of dirty, grody, disgusted now, if you just close your eyes, imagine, I couldn't brush your teeth or shower, like down here in Florida, let's say we have a hurricane, there's no power for a few days. It's kind of hard to take a shower. Water's not running, right? So you just feel bad. Or if you've ever like taken an international trip where you're between airports and airplanes for, you know, 30 hours, you're like, ew, many people, first thing they want to do is take a shower and brush their teeth. Great. So feel, but now feel that, ew, you just feel dirty, grody, disgusted, right? And now if you take that feeling and you put that with the idea of, I'm going to skip the workout today, whether you have a whiny voice in your head to get you to skip it or whatever it is, it's like, ew, I don't want to, not today, wah, that, right? So you put that in there and you now open your eyes, close your eyes. Again, if you imagined you couldn't shower, brush your teeth and you just feel blech, blech. And then that blech goes with the idea of I'm going to skip it today. Yeah. Okay. And you put that together. Now what begins to happen, you're motivated toward going to your goal, right? As well as if you don't do it, you feel bad. So you get the motivation, you get that dopamine boost, you get this, I want to go do it because it's going to feel good. At the same time, if you don't do it, it makes you feel even worse. So when you look at people that do things like exercise or whatever it is regularly, it makes them feel good when they do it and they feel bad when they don't do it, right? And so that the neurobiology of the pleasure is goes back to, right, going into your brain and understanding how it works and using those systems to help you make changes, right? And they're just deep in your brain. And once this happens, you can really start to shape your behavior in the way that you want. And that's it. I'm not, that's a little bit about how your brain, if you want that, reach out to me. I can send you my version of the Godiva chocolate technique for exercise. Or you can use it for anything, because if you're motivated toward and you're motivated away from, you kind of have to do it. But I'm going to invite people to join me on the butterfly experiment. And with the butterfly experiment, I'm calling it the May metamorphosis, right? Where I'm going to do a technique a day, a technique or a process to help you change whatever it happens to be, right? And because, again, I'm calling it the butterfly experiment, because we always talk about how a little caterpillar is crawling around. Does it know it's going to change? Or does it just one day go, I want to be different? Well, the first thing it has to do is kind of has to go into seclusion, right? It has to go into the cocoon. And when it goes into the cocoon, that's where the changes happen. We don't know if it's painful or not, but it basically changes almost everything about itself except its DNA. In fact, its DNA kicks in to change the physical body. It goes from being a caterpillar to being a butterfly, right? So that means in that caterpillar was the DNA for it to be a butterfly, but it hadn't expressed itself. We always talk about, you know, epigenetics, about that's how genes express themselves. So at first it's expressing itself as a caterpillar, and then something happened and it goes, I need to change. And those genes start to change. The DNA starts to release. So it's going to become a butterfly, a totally different being. So it has to kind of go inside and begin to make these changes. And humans go through it. All animals go through it when you go through your maturing phases. When you go from being a little kid to an adolescent, from an adolescent into adult, from adult into later stage adult, we're always going through it. But the difference is, of course, is a butterfly, a caterpillar goes into a cocoon and makes those changes. Great. Well, we're kind of still in a cocoon in this social experiment we call lockdown, social distancing, whatever you want to call it. Well, so you're kind of cloistered from the world. You're in your own little cocoon. What if you use that to help you make some changes? Let's do it, right? And the thing to remember, even if we start doing this, when we, in the next looks like a couple of weeks or week to 10 days, whatever it is, as I say this on April 28th, 2020, as things start to change and things start to open up, you must remember that when that new butterfly comes out of the cocoon, it is totally vulnerable. It's totally vulnerable, right? It has to, you know, first it has to come out, it has to dry, it's wet from the metamorphosis. It can't fly, it can't protect itself, and you can't help it. If you try to help it, like spread its wings or put a little dryer on it or something, it'll die. It has to go through what it has to go through. And then, even then, you know, then it'll hold its wings out and then it takes however long it takes, right? But it's so vulnerable at those moments. So I would dare say in the next few days, we're going to be entering the most vulnerable phase of what we're doing. Those of us that really practice hypnosis and that understand it, understand that, yes, what happens in hypnosis is powerful. Yes, what really happens as you're setting up the hypnosis is as or more powerful than what happens in the hypnosis. And then those that really understand it know in those first few moments when they're coming out of trance and the people think they're awake, but they're really not, that's the most powerful time. And so we've kind of gone through this in a social experiment. The fear that got us to go into the cocoon was one thing. Now we're in the cocoon and things are happening, whatever they happen to be. Let's make a few little changes to help. But also as we start to come out of it, as they start lifting the restrictions and people start changing, that's where, you know, you're vulnerable. So let's use this metaphor in our heads to help us make the changes that we need and that we want, right? So let's have some fun with this. So if you choose to join me, follow me on Facebook. If you're on my email list, I'll be sending that out on how to find it. I think I'll create a Facebook page. Yes, I will. It'll be the Butterfly Experiment or the May Metamorphosis, something like that. The Butterfly Experiment for May Metamorphosis. That's what it'll be called. And so if you just type in Butterfly Experiment, it'll come up hopefully on Facebook, and you can join the Facebook group. It'll be a public group, not private. People can post. And every day I'll post a technique or a process or a tip, you know, and we'll have some fun with it, right? And it'll keep it short. It won't be this long because hopefully things will start picking up, but it'll be like, here's a technique to do this. Here's a technique to do that. Here's what I found with this. And so it's going to make me work because now I got to do, you know, the whole month and have some fun with it. So join me on this. Pick something, you know, use this time for good, as we say. So I'd like to thank you for joining me. And it'll look for the Butterfly Experiment on Facebook. Join us. Have some fun. Make sure you're on my email list so we can, you know, stay in touch. If you have any questions, message me. Let me know what's happening. And we'll try to create some excitement about this because that's what's needed. Excitement breeds change. So I'd like to stay on the call, but I'd like to thank you for joining us.